From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. The libertarian Cato Institute has taken an interest in North Carolina's criminal law reform efforts. A Cato analyst explains why. The nation's longest-running federal judicial vacancy has been filled as Richard Myers was confirmed to serve as a judge in North Carolina's Eastern District. Senator Richard Burr explains his vote of support for Myers. One of the most vocal internal critics of the University of North Carolina system discusses the negative impact of social justice on campus. You'll hear why Mike Adams of UNC Wilmington is concerned. And we'll highlight two important developments that will affect North Carolina's 2020 election campaign. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Later this month, parents and schools across North Carolina, in fact, throughout the country, will join together to celebrate National School Choice Week. It's all about the growing movement to empower parents and kids with an array of choices for how and where kids actually receive their education in this country. North Carolina's school choice movement has grown dramatically over the last two decades or so. Dr. Terry Stoops has chronicled all of that progress, doing a lot of research on his own on the issue. He, of course, is the Vice President for Research, the Director of Education Studies here at the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Give us a sense of nationally how school choice is faring.
School choice is faring very well. Students now have more choices than they ever have. The charter school movement continues to grow in most states. States that don't have charter schools are starting to get them. Most recently, West Virginia passed a law that would start allowing charter schools to be established in that state. Private school voucher programs continue to grow as well. We find that there is a tremendous amount of support for school choice when you look at the polling, especially among African-American parents. I think that there's a real movement there, that there are groups of parents that are finding that the traditional public schools just aren't working for their children. And so they find that the options that are made available to them through voucher programs, increase opportunities for homeschooling and for charter schools are really attractive in being able to provide their child the education that best meets their needs.
You know, Terry, one of the curious things I think is that I think we all understand that every child is different. They have different challenges, different interests, different aptitudes. And so the mere concept of a one-size-fits-all classroom just seems to be obviously not the best thing for every child, even though a traditional public school classroom certainly works for a lot of kids and their parents, and they would choose that, and that's fine. But it always amazes me when you hear some people say, well, we shouldn't have more choices. But here in North Carolina, this movement has grown dramatically for a number of years now. Give us a sense of where we are.
Sure. Right now, around 20% of North Carolina school-age children attend a school of choice. This is homeschools, private schools, and charter schools. And that doesn't include the small number of students that attend magnet schools, which are district schools of choice, where students apply for specialized schools to be able to attend usually in an urban area, and these are mostly located in Charlotte-Mecklenburg and Wake County, Guilford County, Winston-Salem as well. And so we have a large and growing school choice movement here in North Carolina. We're one of the largest percentage-wise states with school choice students. If you look at as a percentage of our total school population, you have 20% in North Carolina, you know, around 25% in Florida. That's probably the only state in the Southeast that is able to best North Carolina when it comes to the share of children that are in schools of choice. So it continues to grow in North Carolina, especially public charter schools. Basically, the population of North Carolina's charter schools have doubled over the last 5 or 6 years. Homeschooling continues to increase at an incredible rate. We now have around 142,000 homeschoolers in North Carolina. And our private school population exceeds 100,000 kids, and it's mostly staying level as to where it has in the past.
One of the people in North Carolina who has really done incredible work to help provide more options to parents is a gentleman named Bob Luddy. And in fact, Bob Luddy is going to be a speaker here at the John Locke Foundation on Monday, January 27th at noon. He is going to be our speaker as we participate in National School Choice Week. And if you can't make it here in Raleigh, actually at John Locke Foundation headquarters to be here in person, just go on to Facebook. We will be live with Bob Luddy's presentation at 12 noon. Terry, tell us a little bit about Bob Luddy's role in choice.
Sure. Bob Luddy was the founder of Franklin Academy Charter School in Wake Forest. It was one of the original North Carolina charter schools established after the law was passed in 1996. And so in the late 90s, Franklin Academy Charter School was founded. It's grown significantly. It has probably one of the largest wait lists of any charter school in the state. Around 1,600 kids attend Franklin Academy Charter School in Wake Forest. And that's how Bob got his feet wet. But he wasn't done. And he mostly now works in the private school sphere with his Thales Academy schools that are, as of 2018, enrolling 3,000 children. There are 8 schools established now in North Carolina. They're moving to other states. A school is going to be founded in Virginia. These are low-cost, high-quality private schools that are incredibly popular. You talk to parents that send their kids to Thales Academy for a third of what they would spend at another private school. And it's not just about the cost, though. The cost is just over $5,000 per year. It's about the quality, and the quality that Thales Academy is able to provide is really exceeds any other type of school that that surrounds them. So he's establishing the Thales Academies, they just continue to grow because the demand for low-cost, high-quality private schools continues to grow.
And again, we are delighted to be hosting Bob Luddy for his remarks and a presentation about school choice as we participate in National School Choice Week. That will be Monday, January 27th, 12 noon, here at the John Locke Foundation in Raleigh. If you'd like to come, just go to our website, johnlocke.org, and you can fill out your registration form right there. Only takes about 60 seconds or so to do that. But if you still want to be part of it and cannot join us in person, not a problem at all. We will be live on Facebook at 12 noon on Monday, January 27th. Terry, let's talk more about some of the types of school choice. You yourself helped to found a public charter school in North Carolina, and charter schools seem to be growing, and there are lots of them in the pipeline. In fact, you and I just recently were looking at a story out of the Asheville area about a group that wants to form a charter school there. Give us a sense of the types of schools that are being formed.
Well, the great thing about the charter school movement in North Carolina is that it's not one size fits all. And so you find that the charter schools that are being founded, some are elementary, some are high school, some target specific student populations, some are targeting just the general population in the area. They have different approaches to curricula, they have different instructional approaches, and that's really the rich types of choice that are available in North Carolina. We have 196 charter schools that enroll around 117,000 kids. And we're seeing the number of charter schools that we're adding every year between 5 and 10. Charter schools looking at diverse ways of educating students, because it's not just about giving them an alternative or a choice, but it's giving them a meaningful choice where a parent can say, look at the curriculum, look at the types of ways that the child is going to be educated in a classroom and determine whether that really is best for their kid. We have kids that come to our school that find that it's not right for them, and they leave and they go to a school that is right for them. That's really what choice is about. It's not just about creating alternatives. It's giving parents the information they need, the opportunities they need to be able to find something that best fits their kids. And we find that in most cases, parents are very satisfied with having that alternative that we provide for them and with every charter school that provides for them. And that's why there's such a demand.
Dr. Terry Stoops is the Vice President for Research, the Director of Education Studies here at the John Locke Foundation. Terry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are, and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The Libertarian Cato Institute is taking note of efforts in North Carolina to clean up the state's criminal code. Cato joined the John Locke Foundation to sponsor a recent day-long forum on criminal law reform. Cato policy analyst Jay Schweikert served as a featured panelist. Why the interest in criminal law reform?
Cato is interested in criminal law reform because we see it as an important first step in building a piece of criminal justice reform more generally. The reason that I work in criminal justice and why Cato has made this such a priority is that failures in our criminal justice public policy really are some of the most serious issues facing our nation and facing individual states that I think we face right now at all. And criminal law reform is, I think, a really significant and important first step toward that, that also has the potential to bring together a lot of different individuals and organizations with, you know, diverse interests and political priorities, but that can all agree on some of the most serious problems that arise from ambiguity, confusion, and duplicativeness in the criminal law.
Why is tackling the criminal code a good first step to take?
Clarification of the criminal law itself is a good first step because, one, the arguments for doing it are really just overdetermined. There really aren't good arguments for having a confusing substantive criminal law that the average citizen can't understand, for having duplication of offenses, for having outdated offenses that may not even be constitutional or more generally just aren't sensible uses of the criminal law. Really, almost everyone can get behind that. I think once you can get those people on board with a sensible, comprehensive, intelligible statement of what actually should be criminal offenses in a particular area, then you can have better, more meaningful, informed discussions about larger questions like sentencing issues, like plea bargaining practices. But until you really know with some degree of precision what is a criminal offense in the first place, those discussions are going to be far more difficult and less productive.
What kinds of problems does it create when people don't know what the laws are?
So I think there are two main sets of problems I see with people not knowing what the law is. One is that, of course, they can't conform their conduct to the criminal law. And there's an inherent basic notion of fundamental fairness in the Anglo-American criminal justice system that criminal offense requires a criminal mind. This is often called the mens rea requirement. You have to be culpable before you can even commit a criminal act. That's sort of a bedrock part of our common law. But with the rise of regulatory offenses and widespread strict liability offenses of other sorts, there's really a fundamental fairness problem in holding people criminally accountable, which is, of course, entails serious risk, including incarceration, when they didn't even know they were acting wrongfully. But I think the second reason it's problematic if people don't know what is criminal is that it undermines respect for the rule of law in general. We would think that the sorts of things that are criminal offenses should be the things that people understand are inherently wrongful. And when they're not, when you criminalize such a wide array of offenses, it makes ordinary, otherwise law-abiding citizens, decent people, into lawbreakers. And it teaches them that something being against the law really isn't that serious of a problem. Things could be illegal, even criminal, and not be wrongful. And that's the exact opposite understanding of what you would want in terms of a relationship between citizens and the state. Rather, you would rather it be the case that there are some offenses which are wrongful, but not criminal. So having a sensible, streamlined codification of the criminal law is important, not just so people can know what is criminal, but so that they'll have respect for the criminal justice system in the first place.
That's the voice of Jay Schweikert, criminal justice policy analyst for the libertarian Cato Institute. You follow these issues from a national perspective. What's your sense of how North Carolina stands compared to other states?
From my conversation so far with North Carolina legislators and other stakeholders in this conversation, there seems to be a lot of genuine interest and enthusiasm for this project and a lot of bipartisan or nonpartisan consensus. So I'm not an expert in North Carolina politics, so I can't give you any specific predictions, but I think that I can see that there's a lot of interest and enthusiasm behind this movement. And I think there are a lot of details to be hashed out, but based on my, you know, limited perspective so far, I'm pretty optimistic that the key decision makers here are taking this problem seriously and working towards a solution.
Could North Carolina set an example for other states?
It would absolutely set a great example for states across the nation if North Carolina could move forward on this project. I think that this is something that there's a lot of states have the potential to take seriously, and really can unite a lot of groups and politicians and organizations that are otherwise disagree on a lot, but have the potential to work together here. I think that requires some degree of trust and some degree of examples of seeing that it can work. And I think if North Carolina can provide that, you could easily see that being a major spur towards states across the nation enacting similar proposals.
What kinds of challenges do you see with this effort to clean up the criminal code?
There are going to be a lot of haggling over the details. I know that one issue that's important to a lot of the municipalities is their ability to have delegation. Basically, a lot of localities feel that there are specific local issues that they need to have some flexibility to address through the criminal law. So I think that there's, you know, going to be a discussion about how extensive that can be. I think one of the baseline requirements that you really would want to see there is, at the very least, if municipalities are going to be creating their own criminal laws, that be done with clarity, that there basically be an opt-in requirement as opposed to an opt-out requirement. But I know that that's an issue that's on the minds of a lot of the folks here. But I think that there are ways to address that are far better than where we are now. And I also think it's worth keeping in mind that a lot of the general criminal statutes can be applied in ways that can address local concerns. So I think that, and part of the reason you need codification is that even municipal decision makers don't always know what is already criminal at the state level. So if you had comprehensive codification, that might actually address a lot of these local concerns, because they might realize they already have the tools available under the general laws.
If this succeeds, what would be different in North Carolina's criminal justice system?
If this proposal moves forward, you could be looking at North Carolina could be a state where you could easily look at and identify what all the criminal laws are. I think that's pretty rare at this point. It's sort of an article of faith that I think most people who work in this field have, that you just, it's never possible to know all, even count all the laws, much less know all of them. So if North Carolina can have, you know, enact some sort of comprehensive codification, it will be a significant difference from where they are now and from where most states are. So I think that could be a very promising development and a sign of things to come from states around the nation.
Does North Carolina need to tackle criminal law reform before it addresses other criminal justice issues?
There are lots of problems at every level of our criminal justice system, from criminal law itself to policing practices to criminal adjudication to accountability for law enforcement. I think it's important to be working on all of those. I don't think that there's any one that is strictly necessary to fix before the others. But I do think the criminal law reform is one of the, if not the most important first steps, because everything else in the criminal justice system flows from what is criminal in the first place. When you have over-criminalization, that affects policing practices. That affects relationship and trust between citizens and law enforcement. That affects what cases are going to trial, or more often are being resolved through plea bargains. So, you know, I don't think that you can. I think the problems are too complex to sort of fix them, strictly speaking, one at a time. But I think that this issue is uniquely well positioned to have positive downstream effects if we can start here.
That's Jay Schweikert, criminal justice policy analyst for the Libertarian Cato Institute. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The nation's longest-lasting federal judicial vacancy has been filled after 14 years. The U.S. Senate voted 68-21 to confirm Richard Myers as a judge for North Carolina's Eastern Federal District. North Carolina's senior senator, Richard Burr, explained his support for Myers.
Professor Myers embodies a work ethic and diligence that we deserve in all our judges. As an immigrant of Kingston, Jamaica, Professor Myers was the first-generation college student in his family. He worked his way through his undergraduate degree at the University of Wilmington, and after college, pursued a career in journalism. He worked for the Wilmington Morning Star, and it was his investigative reporting that gave him the desire to earn his law degree. He graduated magna cum laude at the University of North Carolina Law School and began a legal career as a clerk for Judge David Sintel of the D.C. District Court of Appeals. Second, Professor Myers will be a judge who understands the value of public service. Having made a career change from practicing at a prestigious private firm to contributing to our nation's justice system following the attacks of September the 11th, 2001. He said that his change in career, and I quote him, was something I felt that I could do and that I owed the country that had been really good to my family, unquote. He did this first in the Central District of California and then in the Eastern District of North Carolina. Professor Myers then took a different path of service at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, instructing the next generation of lawyers to be people in his own words, and I quote, do the right thing every day, unquote. Professor Myers will serve on the Eastern District of North Carolina and will hold court in Wilmington. Ironically, this court is currently meeting in the building that once housed the Wilmington Morning Star, his first job as a reporter. However, when considering Professor Myers' story, it seems fitting that someone with the character, work ethic, and servant's approach to life will be returning to the building of his first post-college job wearing a robe of a federal judge. I have faith in Professor Myers' ability to do the right thing every day in this critically important role.
That's North Carolina's senior U.S. Senator Richard Burr explaining his support for the state's newest federal district court judge, Richard Myers. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us. Listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. One of the most vocal internal critics of the University of North Carolina system recently turned his attention to the impact of social justice on campus. UNC Wilmington criminology professor Mike Adams discussed the issue during a forum sponsored by the National Association of Scholars and the Martin Center for Higher Education Renewal. Adams started with an anecdote.
I got up and had to fill out a letter of recommendation to one of my students, great student, and I'm accustomed to filling out these forms. Basically, I have to upload an actual letter, but I have to go through and check boxes and answer questions. One of the questions, actually it was a statement, and I was asked to respond anywhere from strongly agree to strongly disagree. One of the statements was, the applicant is committed to social justice and diversity. Think about that for a moment, how serious that is. First of all, I have no basis whatsoever for judgment. When I teach evidence law in the Federal Rules of Evidence, politics don't come up at all under any circumstances, and I have no opportunity and no desire to judge the politics of my students in the classroom. but I am actually being forced to say that this is a person who is on board with the social justice movement in order to get that person through the application process. Because you better believe if I were to answer in the middle or strongly disagree with that, that would be the end of that student's application to the program. Obviously, we are in a position where the social justice movement is now demanding that we grade our students based upon their politics, effectively, that we evaluate them in that manner. And I think it's very worthwhile for us to stop and ask how we got to this point.
Adams addressed the notion that social justice is tied to Marxist professors.
We do have, I think, an assumption that the social justice movement is just something that kind of naturally flows out of a Marxist worldview, right? Doesn't that make sense? I mean, what it's really all about is redistribution. Now, I am extremely annoyed by my Marxist colleagues. I mean, these people run around and they talk about, you know, having revolutions. They don't own guns, so they're just kind of entertaining and they're annoying. The people that I work with in my department that actually really annoy me and actually scare me a little bit more are actually the postmodernists. And I have plenty of colleagues who are postmodernists, who are truth deniers. And I think we need to talk for just a second about how that worldview has contributed to the current crisis with regard to social justice. It has put in place certain policies that are very dangerous to academic life. First of all, I mean, what could be more dangerous than that? The postmodernist, a person who runs around in higher education and puts scare quotes around the word truth. They actually reject the idea of objective truth, and they think that what we call truth is simply a function of a power struggle between different groups. And just one dominant group has emerged, and they have allowed their narrative to dominate. That's disturbing, because what the hell is the point of having a university if we don't think that the pursuit of truth is possible because truth actually doesn't exist? That's incredibly dangerous. And it really has produced some very serious campus-wide problems.
That's UNC Wilmington criminology professor Mike Adams speaking recently about social justice. Adams says he's focusing much of his attention these days on issues like college campus speech codes.
That is my number one problem with the university system, is the assaults on free speech. But the other thing I've written about more recently in, Federalist Society Review, I co-authored an article with Casey Johnson when we were talking about the issue of due process on college campuses, and specifically the need for us to have right to counsel legislation. These are two issues that have been very important to me, and I hope we can understand how the lack of due process and lack of free speech on college campuses has been a serious issue that's kind of been driven by a postmodern worldview that's kind of morphed into this social justice mission. I mean, stop and think about it for just a moment. It isn't possible for us to have speech codes that actually eliminate all offensive speech, because all speech is offensive to someone. It isn't possible for us to fully eliminate offensive speech unless we fully eliminate dialogue. So what happens in day-to-day life on the college campus is that we are involved in the selective enforcement of campus speech codes. And how do we make a determination as to when we are going to crack down on someone for engaging in offensive speech? We look at demographics, and we ask ourselves, what group was the individual in who was offended by speech? And if that person is a racial minority, if the person is a feminist, if a person is a member of the LGBT community, and heaven forbid, they were offended by someone with white privilege, what do we do? That's when the university steps in. And the purpose in doing that is to what? Make sure that this dominant narrative out there from people who have white privilege is kind of taken down a notch, and that these other narratives, see how that's postmodernism, that these other narratives from disenfranchised groups somehow emerge, not through a free and open marketplace of ideas, but by the university kind of tipping the scales in the whole process of free speech.
How do all of these ideas line up with social justice on campus?
You can see how this is wholly consistent with the idea of social justice and the idea that individuals don't have rights, but groups have rights. And that is antithetical to the entire American experiment. And it is exactly the same way that we should analyze the current problem with campus due process. all of a sudden, in the last 4 years of the Obama administration, we see a 49% increase in sexual assault on college campuses. How is that possible if sexual assault, like every other predatory crime, has been declining for over a quarter of a century steadily since about 1992, by the way? How is that possible? Well, we've changed our reporting procedures on campuses, haven't we? And we have created this false epidemic out there. Why? Okay. Well, we've created the problem so that we can now come along with the solution. The solution is what? Now that we have this epidemic, we need to do something about it. They have decided that we need to erode the presumption of innocence, the standard of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the protection of double jeopardy. Why? Because now the purpose of the campus judiciary is not to find the truth. Remember, truth doesn't exist. It's to be used in scare quotes. It is to promote a narrative from a disenfranchised group on college campuses, namely women. So what if a few innocent men are convicted in the process? We are engaged in a leveling process in which we're engaged in a war on white privilege, essentially. Okay. A white male privilege, I should say, in this context. It is very disturbing, because obviously, this philosophy has greatly disrupted campus life. The erosion of due process, and more importantly, I think the erosion of free speech, has really undermined the very idea of what the university's purpose should be.
Adams says there's some recent good news in North Carolina. State legislation has helped fight campus free speech restrictions, and North Carolina was the first state to approve a law guaranteeing due process rights for students charged in campus courts.
The effects of the postmodern-driven social justice movement have been very negative with regard to the campus-wide community. But we have managed to use the legislature to fight back to a degree. And there's a lesson in that. We have to have that relationship between right-thinking faculty members and the legislature. And we have to use them as a tool for fighting back, because the problems that we have are so incredibly deep.
That's Mike Adams, UNC Wilmington criminology professor, speaking recently in Raleigh for the National Association of Scholars and the Martin Center for Higher Education Renewal. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio and the first 2020 installment of Locker Room Talk. I'm Donna Martinez, joined here by my co-host, Mitch Kokai. Mitch, good to have you with me here again so we can chit-chat just between you and I.
Yeah.
I can't even believe it's 2020 yet, but what I really can't believe is that we are now into a presidential election year. And if you can believe this, folks, in less than 6 weeks, we will be voting in North Carolina in our primary, a big Super Tuesday in early March. But Mitch, a fascinating controversy continuing to roil here in North Carolina, having to do with photo ID to vote. Now, we had a constitutional amendment that was approved by North Carolina voters overwhelmingly to require ID in order to vote. Many states do that, so North Carolina clearly within the mainstream, and yet continued legal challenges. Now we have a situation where a judge has stepped in and said, no, you cannot require photo ID to vote on March 3rd.
Yeah, it's amazing that this has happened. As you alluded to, North Carolina is out of the mainstream by not having voter ID. Well over 30 states, a clear majority of the states in the union have some sort of voter ID, most of them also with a photo ID, which is what we were talking about here in North Carolina. North Carolina initially tried to have a voter ID back in 2013. That was struck down in the federal courts. And at that time, one of the primary reasons that happened is that voter ID was tied with a number of other election changes. And a panel of federal court judges said, look, all of these changes together look like they had some sort of racial impact, that there was an attempt to suppress the minority vote. In fact, the phrase almost surgical precision came out of that discussion. So at that time, voter ID and the other changes were all struck down. The General Assembly went back and said, we still want to have voter ID. Let's put this in front of the voters of North Carolina and see what they think. So a voter ID constitutional amendment was placed on the ballot. North Carolina voters said, yes, it makes sense. Let's have people have a voter ID so we ensure that people's votes aren't diluted by those who aren't supposed to vote. And so in late 2018, the General Assembly comes back to pass a law to implement the constitutional amendment as approved. And in fact, if you look at the types of IDs that would be accepted, it's almost everything. It's not just the driver's license, which would be what most people would use.
And in fact, a lot of people were criticizing the legislation that was going to implement this because they said it is now so diluted you could come up with anything virtually to walk in and be able to vote.
Yeah. In fact, the voter ID proponents, those who've been advocates of it, were not big fans of this proposal because they thought, you know, this was kind of a watered down version of what would really work. But even beyond just the types of IDs that would count, the provisions in the new law said that if you didn't have an ID, you could show up at your county board of elections and the county board of elections would give you a voter ID. So there is absolutely nothing about this that would block anyone who is eligible to vote from voting. Yet a federal judge, Loretta Biggs, said no. There's been a history of racial animus in voting laws, and it looks as if this is targeting racial minority groups. So we're going to put an injunction in place, no voter ID for the primary, and nothing will happen until there's a trial. The state attorney general, Josh Stein, has said he will appeal the ruling, but not before the primary. So at this point, no voter ID for the primary.
That is the curious thing, Mitch. Any speculation as to why Attorney General Stein is saying, yeah, I will appeal, but not right now?
Well, in some respects, this is a mirror image of the argument that Republicans made about changing election maps close to an election. And that is, we are so close to the primary election and the ballots being printed and all of that process starting, that to try to challenge this election and get a change would cause mass confusion. So he is saying it's not because I don't want it for the primary, but it's because it would cause chaos. Although a lot of people are looking at it as a potentially Democratic Attorney General Josh Stein, Democrat Governor Roy Cooper, Democratic activists who are the ones pushing against voter ID, all working in cahoots. I don't know that that's true, but that certainly could be a possibility.
Here's the tough thing for North Carolina, I think, Mitch. There is no doubt. I mean, you just read U.S. history, and the South and North Carolina has a very ugly and troubling past history of what was very real, voter discrimination and trying to keep certain people away from the polls and having their voice heard. But how do we kind of go forward into 2020 and acknowledge our past, but say that's not the way it is now in 2020, particularly since I think we have some voting statistics of the past several elections that show that actually minority voting turnout has been up in certain circumstances. How do we move beyond that in this state?
It's going to be hard to see how that happens the way that, that things are playing out, because most of the concerns that have been cropping up in terms of a racial aspect to elections have tended to be from the Democratic Party aligned interest groups who I think some critics would say are using those arguments as a way to get what Democrats want rather than try to deal with the specific concerns of African Americans or other minority groups. On the voter ID piece, a key part of this is that the law that was passed, the one that was just enjoined by the federal judge, was co-sponsored by an African American state senator, and several African Americans within the General Assembly voted for it. So I can't imagine that any of them were voting for a bill that they thought would disenfranchise African Americans.
So as it stands on the March 3rd presidential primary, when we in North Carolina will be among those states voting on what's known as Super Tuesday, no photo ID will be required to vote. So stay tuned on that. And of course, Carolina Journal reporting on this story and every development. You can check out carolinajournal.com, also on Twitter at Carolina Journal for the latest updates on that. Okay, so presidential primary, we know on the Republican side, we've got President Trump running for re-election. He will be on the North Carolina ballot. There was a lot of thought, Mitch, that he was going to be the only candidate representing the Republican Party, but not so. Two more people have been added to the ballot, and apparently the state Republican Party did not want that to occur, but the elections board said, we will add them to the ballot.
And the elections board has the final say on this. The Republican Party and the Democratic Party put forward their names of the candidates that they wanted. And the Republican Party said, look, Donald Trump's going to be the nominee. He has widespread support within the Republican Party. There's no reason to have a contested primary. But the state Board of Elections, responding to complaints from the two candidates, including Bill Weld, the former governor of Massachusetts, they said, look, these people are legitimate national candidates. They should have a chance to have a shot at it. So we'll see those additional names.
And it's going to be quite an interesting presidential ballot because we have five political parties represented on the ballot. Now, you're thinking, what are the five? Of course, we know about the Democrats and the Republicans, but we have presidential candidates from the Libertarian Party, also the Green Party, and the Constitution Party. So, Mitch, it should be very interesting to see how those candidates shake out. A big, big day, voting day in North Carolina. That will be Tuesday, March 3rd. We are part of Super Tuesday. Mitch, it was great to actually be across the table from you here for Locker Room Talk, our first installment of 2020. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, and I'm sure we'll be doing this again as we get closer and closer to Election Day.
Absolutely. That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of Mitch and me, we hope you'll join us again next week here on Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.